What a real thrill, and I mean thrill it is, to talk with James B. Murphy today, author of Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961 to 1963. And James Murphy, the first thing I want to do is welcome you in. Thank you so much for joining us today on Book Corner.
Oh, it's a pleasure. The pleasure is all mine. And please call me Jim. I use the formal James for the publisher and for the book, but I really go by Jim. But it's great to be here and excited to talk about the early days of the Beach Boys.
What do the Beach Boys, Jim Murphy, mean to you?
The Beach Boys, you know, I became a fan when I was 10 years old. It was 1966, and I first heard Good Vibrations through my older brother, Rich, who was 16 at the time. I was 10. And I think they've just come to mean a lifelong of joy, a life of listening pleasure, and they have such an interesting, fascinating catalog of music. So many different phases. I always loved the idea of, you know, three brothers, a cousin, a buddy, forming this rock and roll band literally in the garage of their home and just blossoming with, you know, the musical talent of Brian Wilson and then the harmonies that were built on, you know, the close relationships of the brothers. And then all of them just blossomed with musical talent. And, you know, and 55, 56 years later, they're still, you know, they're still going strong at it. And they have such a rich catalog of music, and you can never be sad when you listen to a Beach Boy record. You know, no matter what phase of their career you tend to choose to play or gravitate towards, they always bring you up. I mean, they just have such a wonderful, you know, sort of majestic catalog of music.
What's really mind-boggling to me is how young they are in this time period where you're chronicling them from 1961 through 63. It's really hard for me to wrap my brain around Brian Wilson at the age of 18 being so prolific in that he wasn't what you would call highly trained musically. He just had it, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I think the only musical training Brian had was as a very, very young boy. His parents gave him some lessons on an accordion. And the story goes that, you know, after just a couple of lessons, the teacher sort of told Audrey Wilson, his mother, listen, I think you're wasting your money. He hears a piece of music once, and he can play it back perfectly. Sort of, I don't think he needs lessons. He got music. He was a musical prodigy. He just understood the language of music. And that was his only formal lesson. He took a music course his first year in college, you know, where he learned some theory and some musical composition, I think. But that wasn't a true lesson. By that point, he was already composing songs and, you know, recording on his Wallensack reel-to-reel tape deck. And as you mentioned, the first time the Beach Boys go into the studio, Mike Love is the oldest. He's 20 years old. Brian Wilson and Al Jardine are both 19. Dennis Wilson is 17. Carl Wilson is 15. And when you hear their first tapes, their first recordings, the so-called Height Morgan session, Height and Dorinda Morgan, was a married couple who were in their late 40s, on the fringe of the L.A. music industry, and they used to record demos in their living room studio in L.A. They were the first people to produce the Beach Boys. They were friends of Murray Wilson, and they produced 9 songs over 4 sessions from September of 1961 through March of 1962. And these sessions are being released, actually, on Omnivore Recordings on August 26th. It's going to be a 2-CD set, and I had the privilege of writing the liner notes for it. And Brad Rosenberger, who is a co-owner and co-partner of Omnivore Recordings, is a big Brian Wilson fan, huge Beach Boy fan, and he wanted to do it right. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful package. Every one of their early recordings is going to be released on this, every single second of tape, every false start, mistake, master take, redo kind of thing, studio banter, studio chatter. And the thing that you come away with is, okay, they're 20, 2 of them are 19, and then you have a 17 and a 15-year-old, and you think, they're really good. They're really, really good right out of the box, so to speak. And they conduct themselves very professionally. They're young kids, and you know, you think back to your own life, what you were doing at 15 or 17 or 19. And they were very serious, very determined, and very, very talented right in the beginning, right out of the gate. They're an amazing story. I don't think there's any other band, not in America, that can really match or parallel the Beach Boys' fantastic musical journey. It's a musical journey that will never disappoint you. It's always a satisfying journey.
What's incredible about the Beach Boys to me in reading your work and what really stands out, especially from this time period, is that there are so many moving parts. Mm-hmm. First of all, they were thought to be a flash in the pan. They had a regional hit, and right in the middle of the surf boom, but many record labels at that point in time just essentially thumbed their nose at them, would not take a chance on them. Meanwhile, these kids continue to work at their craft, but there are so many sides to their journey. And you talked about Dorinda and Hype Morgan before, but there are so many sides to their journey that I just never knew about. So many bit players in here. One thing that you did in this book, I don't know how you could ever possibly cover these 3 years more in depth than you did. Kudos to you. It's incredible the amount of information on these pages, but I really thought the stuff on Dorinda and Hype Morgan was really interesting.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because one of the motivating forces for me to begin writing the book back in April of 2006 was being a big Beach Boy fan. I have all the music, all the CDs, everything that they released pretty much, and that's not uncommon for anyone who's a fan of any given band. But I also read everything, every book, every documentary, you know, every magazine article that I could get my hands on. And I always came away, and this is no disrespect to any previous author, but I always came away with more questions about their early history than answers. And I could never seem to find one cohesive narrative that kind of put it all together and made sense as to, you know, what happened, when did it happen, you know, how things proceeded. So I kind of set out to maybe just write an article that, you know, was going to be maybe 10 or 12 pages, and maybe I would try to pitch it to a Goldmine magazine or something, or just publish it online kind of thing. And it just grew and grew and grew from there. And I just started interviewing more people, and then one person would say, hey, have you talked to so-and-so? And so one interview would lead to four interviews, and then eight interviews, and, you know, kind of took a life of its own. 8 years later, I kind of finished the manuscript. I'm a veterinarian by trade, so I worked a lot at night and on weekends, and finished it and got a publisher, McFarland Books, Jefferson, North Carolina, here in the States, and was very, very happy to see it kind of published. And fortunately, Beach Boy fans have responded very, very enthusiastically about it, because I think it is the first book that just took their origin story. You know, it began when, you know, when the boys were small, and what music were they listening to? What music were their parents listening to? What were they like in high school? The high school assemblies that Brian would form an impromptu vocal quartet and then perform at various high school assemblies. And Al Jardine had his own little folk trio, kind of modeled after the Kingston Trio. He was very active musically in high school. How they kind of came together and coalesced and then write this very, very simple song, Surfin', which goes to number three in L.A., which is a very respectable hit. It was number three on KRLA and KFWB in Los Angeles. Goes to number 75 nationally in Billboard, and then stalls. Drops off the chart in March of 62, late March of 62. And they're basically without a label. And they've got Surfin' Safari in the can. They've already recorded an early version of Surfin' Safari. They have an early version of Surfer Girl. And they have a few other songs in the can, but they can't quite come up with that all-important follow-up single. So a lot of groups had that first hit, the so-called one-hit wonder, and Beach Boys had that with Surfin'. So here it is, March going into April of 62. They're without a record label, and they're struggling to find a company that will have faith in them and pick them up and have that all-important second hit. And that's where I think their own perseverance, their own determination, their own musical talent, and Brian Wilson's gifts for music and melody and harmony, Mike Love's gifts for lyrics, Carl's and Dennis's musical ability as far as playing instruments. And then Brian meets, in January of 62, he meets a singer-songwriter called Gary Usher. And Usher was a huge sort of shot in the pants for Brian kind of thing. It was like he would tell Brian things like, hey, the record companies are not going to come knocking on your door. You've got to get up and knock on their doors. So let's go down to Western Recorders in L.A. Let's make a demo of some of our own songs and your songs, and let's start shopping that demo around. And that's what they did. Around mid-April of 62, they go into Western, and they re-record Surf Safari. They recorded a brand-new song called 409 that Brian had written with Gary Usher and a couple of other songs, and they have like basically a four- or five-song demo reel that Murray Wilson starts shopping around to record companies. And as you mentioned before, a lot of major companies turned them down. Liberty was huge on the West Coast at the time. Liberty turned them down. Dot Records turned them down. Original Sound turned them down. And then Capitol took a chance. Nick Vinay was a young, kind of hotshot record producer. He was famous for producing the Letterman at the time, actually, another vocal harmony group on Capitol, kind of picking up the mantle of the Four Freshmen. It's interesting how the Four Freshmen were on Capitol, the Letterman were on Capitol, the Four Preps were on Capitol, So Capitol has got this rich history of vocal harmony groups. Anyway, they go into Vinay's office. They play him the demo of Serpent Safari in 409. That happens around May 18th, or May 10th, rather, I'm sorry. And May 24th, they're signed to Capitol Records. They have a seven-year contract. And they're so young, four out of the five Beach Boys are minors still, Mike Love being the only one who had just turned 21 that March. Capitol has Murray Wilson sign the contract on behalf of his minor boys, and then also Al Jardine.
Glad you mentioned Murray Wilson, because time has dealt with Murray Wilson the same way that time has dealt with Joe Jackson of the Jackson 5. He drove them. He was heavy-handed. He had them under lock and key. I don't get that from your book, though. I mean, I get that he was kind of a nuisance, and I get that at times he was kind of in the way, but he doesn't seem to be to be as heavy-handed as Joe Jackson was.
Murray Wilson is a very enigmatic figure. Let me just first say, I don't pretend to know exactly what happened at the Wilson home when the boys were growing up. Murray was a middle-class guy, struggling. He had a two-bedroom bungalow, basically one-story bungalow. He had three boys, very, very close in age. Brian, Dennis, and Carl were 2 years apart. His wife, Audrey, was a homemaker. He had a little business himself where he rented lathes and business equipment and machine shop kind of thing. And, yeah, he wasn't making a lot of money, and singer-songwriter himself kind of thing. He had a little success in the music industry, minor success with some songs that he had written. So he was kind of a struggling guy. And it was very typical, I think, of a lot of American fathers in the post-World War II era. And Brian comes along in 42, Dennis in 44, and Carl in 1946. That's Murray's kind of template. He's a bit of a product, as we all are, of his own parents and his own upbringing. He was born in 1917, born right on the tail end of World War I. He lives through the Depression. He lives through World War II. He wasn't capable of going into the service for World War II, actually. So, he had a lot of disruptions in his life when you look at where he lived and how he grew up. He's famous for being a harsh disciplinarian, and some of his discipline perhaps bordered on, other writers have said, sadism or just too harsh or too cruel. Perhaps that's true. You know, I'm not trying to make him out a saint kind of thing, but I try to look at him more objectively. A lot was written about him sometimes by people who had their own agendas and wanted to kind of say bad things about him. Some of the boys themselves, some of his sons, have said some things about him that were none too flattering either. But on the positive note, no one believed in the Wilson brothers and the Beach Boys more than Murray Wilson. No one wanted them to succeed more than Murray Wilson. He did an awful lot for them in the beginning. He bought them instruments, he bought them amplifiers, he paid for sessions, he drove them around, he called radio stations, disc jockeys, program directors, he booked them on shows, get them more exposure. He was very concerned about their public appearance and how they dressed, for their haircuts, and, you know, made sure that they didn't curse and made sure that they didn't give way to temptations on the road. In a lot of real ways, without Murray Wilson, there would be no Beach Boys. I think Murray's, one of his major flaws, if I can be so bold as to say what I think is his a fault of his, was not knowing when to pull back. Certainly by 63, early 64, he should have just said, you know, listen, you guys know what you're doing. You've got, you know, let me pull back. I'll be your dad. I'm here if you need me. But you can produce these records and do the sessions yourself. And it just got to be too much friction, I think. You know, the boys were all growing into young men. They were very accomplished. They were very wealthy. They knew what they were doing. And there was some natural father-son conflicts there.
James B. Murphy, Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961 to 1963. It's available from McFarland. And let me tell you, if you're a Beach Boys fan and you have a bunch of books written about them and you don't have this one, you better get this one in your collection. That's all I'm saying. If you're a fan of that early period of music, the California scene, what was going on out there, that's intriguing to you. Early rock and roll, there's a ton of that in here, including Brian Wilson's influences. A lot of time is spent on that and who Brian was. And at a very young age, Brian showed I guess we would call genius-type qualities. Jim at a pretty early age. But another thing that he showed was the ability to manage his father. I think it was in 1962. They're already trying to find things to do, though, with Murray to kind of keep him occupied when he's in the studio, to kind of keep him out of the way.
Yeah, that's a good point. Murray wanted to be involved in his boy's life. He had been a songwriter since the early 50s. He had a couple of successes. He wrote a song called I'll Hide My Tears that the R&B vocal group The Jets did, Aladdin Records. It's a very sought-after record now. It actually goes for hundreds and hundreds of dollars if you can find an original copy in mint shape, which is kind of ironic because when you look at the writing credit on it, it's Murray Wilson. So you don't think of this great R&B sought-after doo-wop vocal group as being written by the father of the Beach Boys. So he had that. He also had a song called Sidestep, Two-Step. That was sort of recorded by Lawrence Welk and a whole bunch of folks on various labels, actually. So those were Murray's big claims to fame. Let me correct the title. Actually, it was Two-Step, Sidestep. I always have trouble with that song title. So Murray is a songwriter. He's got a piano at home. He's got an organ at home. His wife, Audrey, sings and plays, and they just love music. Again, they grew out of that generation born in 1917 era kind of thing. Right during World War I is when they were born. And he's a teenager during the Depression. There's not a lot of money growing up. Music was a source of entertainment and a source of joy, both for his family and for his wife's family before they met and got married. So music was always close to his heart. So the boys grew up with all that music. They grew up hearing the music that Murray loved, the big band era kind of thing from the 40s. He instilled, I think, in all of his sons this love of music. I think that was really a key, I think, for Brian's early development, too, because Brian hears Rhapsody in Blue around age 2, and he's just struck by it and goes to the piano, and his mother is playing the chords, and he knew exactly what kind of chords he wanted to hear again, and he would ask his mother and communicate to her that he wanted to hear that chord again, that, you know, there was just something about the chord and the sound of it that would awaken something in Brian's soul.
Yeah, and the other thing that's, I like the part where he's talking about his influences and Rosemary Clooney, and he says, because I love Rosemary Clooney myself, but I've never really thought about this. My dad fought in World War II, and my parents are of a similar age to Brian Wilson's folks, all in that same generation, the same kind of music. And the way Brian puts it about Rosemary Clooney, he said she sung with joy. Who would think that of all the people for him to say that he patterned himself after Rosemary Clooney? That just seems so out of left field until I think about her singing style, and her singing style was very joyful. And that's Brian Wilson's music, because you've said about the Beach Boys several times, you can't not put a Beach Boy record on, even a sad song, and think to yourself, my gosh, these guys are lifting up my spirits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's, I think that's the genius of the Beach Boys music, is that it's just joyful music. It's the celebration of the joy of living, the joy of being alive. Summer, summer vacation, going to the beach, cruising the strip with your friends, falling in love for the first time, getting married, you're facing life's challenges as a young person or a young adult. It celebrates the joy. You can't not possibly be depressed for too long if you listen to some Beach Boy music. One of the most telling things, and I use this in my book, is Carl Wilson and Brian Wilson were talking very later in their career, before Carl passed away in 98. And they were just talking about, like, why do you think we hit it so big? Why do you think the Beach Boys were so successful? And Brian said, I think it's simple. I think it's just we sang about the joy of living, the joy of life. That's kind of what it comes down to. But, yeah, he got that at a young age. I think he got that from Gershwin, from Rhapsody in Blue. He got that from Rosemary Clooney. He got that from the music that he grew up listening, which was, you know, Brian was a child of the 50s, basically, born in 1942. He grows up basically during the birth of rock and roll. Chuck Berry was a huge influence. Bill Haley was an influence. Little Richard was a big influence on Carl Wilson. A lot of that happy, happy music, actually, and birth of rock and roll was very explosive, like anything else. And I think he took that also with the music that he had grown up with listening from Murray and Audrey, and there was this nice sort of marrying of the two. Takes the electric guitar and the Chuck Berry rhythms and the Four Freshmen harmonies. And the Four Freshmen were the premier vocal group of the 1950s, but they were more like parents-type music. You know, the Four Freshmen weren't exactly appealing to a lot of teenagers in the late 50s or early 60s.
Your book talks about how Brian would sit there with his school buddies, and they'd work up Four Freshmen songs. And he would take the harmonies, and he could tell you what each individual in the four freshmen was doing. You sing this part. While I'm singing this, you sing that. You sing this, and you sing that. And I got to tell you, as somebody that plays guitar, plays mandolin, teaches some music myself, that is frightening to think that somebody can hear on that level to be able to tell the melody, the harmony, you're singing a third, you're singing a sixth, you're doing this. I mean, that is frightening to think that somebody could be that musically adept to be able to pull all that apart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what separates the person who can become very proficient on piano or guitar and play beautifully, note for note, a piece of music that, you know, someone else has written. And there's lots of folks like that that are extremely talented and very adept. And then there's somebody like Brian Wilson and others, too, who just is just far and above any other human talent. They can hear things. They understand music. They get the language. They can conceptualize. Perhaps they see it in their head kind of thing. They just get it. They understand how it works. And he did that at a very young age. In 1955, he's driving in a car with his mom. His mom is driving, and they're driving around Hawthorne, California, where they grew up, and he hears Day by Day on the radio by the four freshmen. And they stop at a record store, and he goes in and buys it, and he gets the album, I think, that the Day by Day by the four freshmen was on. And from 1955, basically to 1960, those 5 years, he teaches himself vocal harmony. And basically, just by having his little phonograph player, his record player, his upright piano, and his bed was right next to it, all in sort of close proximity. So he can sleep, he can get up and play the piano, and he's got his phonograph player there and his record collection. And he would put his four freshmen song on, he'd play a couple of bars, lift the needle up, go to the piano, and stay at the piano until he figured out those one or two or three bars. Then he'd go back to the record, drop the needle again, and do the next one or two or three bars, go back to the piano. He did that maybe every day, hours and hours and hours, from 1955 to 1960, until he could almost play and master every song in the Four Freshmen's catalog. Years later, when he meets Wagner, the Four Freshmen's manager, he looks them up in the phone book. He goes down to talk to the manager, and he goes in and he introduces himself, and he says he's a big fan, and the manager challenges him and says, oh yeah, well, you know, play me this song. Can't remember the title of the song right now, but he picks out a song that the four freshmen had a really, really hard time singing, a very, very challenging song. Lots of jazzy chords and ups and downs, lots of different things going on, a lot of movement vocally. He plays the song for Brian in the office. Brian, I think, listens to it a couple of times maybe, and then sits down and plays each part perfectly. And Wagner says, well, you know, why are you here? He says, I want to form a band, and I'd like you to teach me how. Brian was kind of like their secret weapon almost. And no one realized this fully now. You know, we know it now looking back through the lens of time. But at the time, I think he was almost taken for granted a little bit until people started looking at all the Beach Boy albums. And 10 out of 12 songs were written by Brian Wilson. Or, you know, Brian Wilson, Mike Love, Brian Wilson, Gary Usher, Brian Wilson, Roger Christian. You know, Brian often would work with a collaborator. He seemed to work best when he had someone to bounce ideas off of. So Mike Love was his earliest collaborator. Then guys like Gary Usher and Tony Asher, Roger Christian, Van Dyke Parks. We get into the later years. Look at the record albums and you see Brian Wilson's name is all over the place, arranged by, produced by. He was singing. He was playing bass. He was touring. He was one of the first American musicians to do it all. So many of the great groups that came afterwards will tell you the same thing, that Brian opened so many doors for young musicians that followed.
James B. Murphy joining Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961 to 1963. It's from McFarland, and it is really a tremendous book. And we spent some time on Brian Wilson. I think we could go for 5 hours if we wanted to. There's so much in your book. But one of the things that blows me away is this period that we're talking about here from 61 through 63, when the Beach Boys really launch and become, as we know the Beach Boys, completely go from an obscure regional one-hit wonder, a curiosity in the surf scene, that kind of music, beach music, into this worldwide phenomena. But there is a young kid named Brian Wilson, and correct me if I'm wrong, he's got to be what? When he writes Surfer Girl, 19 years old, 20 years, how old is he there, 19?
When he writes Surfer Girl, he's 19. He's 19 years old when he writes Surfer Girl.
I mean, that's incredible to me. That's
sure.
Just, you say, though, that the original Surfer Girl that's going to be available shortly, and you're writing the liner notes for this release of these works that will be coming out later in the summer, you say that Surfer Girl sounds different than the one that we end up hearing.
It is. It's their first attempt at recording it. The instrumentation is not nearly as lush. The production is not as sophisticated. The vocal harmony is not as mature, I think, as what we hear later on. The interesting thing about Surfer Girl is it's one of the first songs Brian wrote, and he has said publicly that he actually wrote it before Surfin'. So he may have had this song sort of in its infancy kind of thing, even before the Beach Boys record Surfin', their first single ever. So he's kind of nurturing this song. They record it February 8th, 1962, and they do several takes, all of which are going to be released on this Omnivore Recordings 2-CD package on August 26th. And it doesn't come out then. So it's recorded February 8th, 1962, in sort of its infancy form kind of thing, a very kind of early version of it. The version that we're familiar with comes out in June of 1963. So it comes out much, much later, I think June or July, actually, of 63. So, you know, we're looking at a good 17 months later, and it's interesting how Brian held that song back. If you think chronologically, here we are, February of 62, when they record Surfer Girl. May of 62 is when they sign the contract with Capitol. June of 62 is the first Beach Boys single, and that's Serpent Safari backed at 409. The follow-up single on Capitol was sort of a misfire. It was an unusual song called 10 Little Indians, which hit number 49, which is respectable, but it was a disappointment after Serpent Safari in 409, which hit number 14. So they kind of went back to the drawing board a little bit. But all the while, Brian's got this great song, Surfer Girl, in his catalog, and he's not releasing it yet. After 10 Little Indians stalls at 49 at the end of 62, they kind of regroup. It sent a little bit of a shockwave, actually, through the group. And then they come out with Surfin' USA. Now, of course, Surfin' USA borrowed heavily on the Chuck Berry's melody for Sweet Little 16. And in fact, Leonard Chess of Chess Records and ARC, ARC Music Corporation, Chuck Berry's music publishing company, through Chess, sued successfully, actually, for copyright infringement on the melody of Sweet Little 16. So the Beach Boys actually don't see any money financially from Surfin' USA, but Surfin' USA was a huge hit. Surfin' USA just exploded out of AM radios in March of 63. It was backed with Shutdown, so it was another one of their double-sided hits. They had Surf and Safari on one side, 409 on the other. And they had this pattern of like a surf song on one side and a car song on the flip side. And Surfin' USA followed that up in March of 63. You have Surfin' USA and then Shutdown. Huge, huge single. At the same time, Brian pretty much writes and helps Jan and Dean finish Surf City, which goes to number one in the summer of 63. And then he finally decides to release Surfer Girl. But he releases it on his own terms. I think it's a song that is very, very important to him. It's very, very tender, very spiritual, and written, actually, inspired by his first serious romantic relationship with a girl by the name of Judy Bowles. And he dated Judy for a good 2.25 years. He presented her with a diamond ring for Christmas of 1962. They were thinking of getting married the following Christmas, or the following December of 63, but the pressures of the music industry and their divergent paths in life, basically, the relationship fell apart, and they never did wind up getting married. But Judy was certainly the inspiration for Surfer Girl. So the song is very important to Brian, and I think in the summer of 63, he's finally ready to say, okay, I want to record it the way I want it to be. The version we first recorded in February 1962, too simple, too primitive. I've got much greater ideas. We hear the lush harmonies and the sophisticated orchestration and the instrumentation, and that's the Surfer Girl we've come to know and love. Because that song, I think, was so important to him, whether it be just because one of his earliest compositions with Judy Bowles in mind, who he was deeply in love with, and then Surfer Girl comes out, and then the album Surfer Girl comes out in the fall of 63. That cements the Beach Boys' reputation, I think, in 63. You know, they had these fast, great rock and roll songs that sounded great on AM radio, like Surfin' USA. They had the car songs like Shutdown and Little Deuce Coupe, also in 63. But then they could also do the tender ballads like Surfer Girl and In My Room. So they had these kind of like two sides of the coin. They could do great, fast rock and roll songs with Mike Love's great voice. And then they could do a tender ballad like Don't Worry Baby, In My Room, Surfer Girl. It was almost like two groups in one. And back then, for 75 cents, you could buy a 45 and get two great songs on both sides. Brian Wilson almost single-handedly reinvigorated or reinvented the 45. Prior to that, B-sides were just the wasteland. You didn't put anything good on the B-side. The B-side was, you know, an instrumental or some terrible song you didn't care about, because people had to buy the B-side anyway. You know, if you wanted the A-side, yeah, the B-side came along with it. But Brian was the first guy to say, you know, well, wait a second, let's treat the single with a little more respect. Let's put a great song on the B-side as well. So that's why those early Beach Boys singles are just phenomenal. And in fact, it's an interesting study. If you took those singles and separated the B-sides from the A-sides and made them each their own A-side, the Beach Boys would have had a staggering number of hits in the early years. It would have probably rivaled or surpassed what the Beatles did in 64 when they first landed America.
Well, and one other thing about the Beach Boys that I learned from your work that I appreciate about them versus, say, the Beatles. And when the Beatles hit, you made the point to me on the phone the other day, they had more than a pocket full of songs. And they were a tried and true and tested live act as well, because, for lack of a better term, they woodshedded. And they played every night. And they would play three sets a night in the Cavern Club. And they played all over Europe. And the Beach Boys, it just kind of happened for them. And then it came time to, well, we got to put our first album out, so let's just kind of use what we have. And then all the pressure falls on Brian Wilson, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Surfing falls off the charts in March of 62. They kind of hunk down. They come up with this 4 or 5 song demo. They get the contract with Capitol. It's a 7-year contract. And back then, you know, it was not unheard of for groups to have 3 albums a year. The pace was just crazy. In later years in the music industry, it reversed. It was 1 album every 3 years. And there's a lot of pressure from Capitol Records, a lot of pressure from the family. So in May of 62, they had this 7-year contract, and it's great. And they're ready with their first single, Surfing Safari 409, recorded so well as a demo that Capitol doesn't even make them re-record it. Capitol says, no, it's fine just the way it is. We'll equalize it. We'll change the fade a little bit, but we're going to press it right away and get it out in the summer. Comes out June 4th, 1962, a nice summer single, Surfing Safari back to 409. But after that, the Beach Boys didn't have a lot of depth song-wise. So they're a green group, so to speak, with Capitol. Capitol has no idea if the Beach Boys are going to be successful. They think they're going to be successful. They hear a lot of talent in it. They signed to a 7-year contract, so they obviously had a lot of faith in them. But they wanted to see how Surfing Safari and 409 did. It does well enough. Surfing Safari hits number 14 in Billboard. So Capitol says, hey, let's get an album out. And back then, the record industry wasn't like, okay, let's get an album out next year, or, you know, take your time, here's a whole bunch of money, work on the album like a piece of art. It wasn't that way at all. It was, we need an album, and we need it yesterday. So get in the studio right away. They did their first album, the Surfing Safari album, in 3 sessions, one in August, and then a couple of weeks later in early September. And Brian, basically, with Mike Love and his buddy, his new friend Gary Usher, basically go to the drawing board, and they go to the Wilson's music room, where Brian had studied the Four Freshmen as a teenager, and they convene, and they just write a bunch of songs. And they write songs that teenagers in America kind of cared about. Surf songs and growing up and songs about root beer and songs about surfboards and things like that. And they're very cute songs, certainly not Pet Sounds and Good Vibrations and Smile and the genius that was to come later. There's only one outtake from the first Beach Boy album. It was kind of like, we don't have a lot of depth of material here. We've got this bunch of songs. We're going to record them and we're going to release them. And the one outtake got released years later, but they didn't have a lot of extra things left in the can. So the Surfing Safari album comes out in September, or I think October of 62, fall of 62, does very, very well, and then the pressure's back on. The pressure from that point on probably doesn't relent for the next decade, because it's Capitol's like, okay, let's repeat. We need a new single. We need a new album. That was getting on the treadmill, so to speak. And that's where Surfing USA comes in. The lyrics to Surfing USA, the locales and the exotic surf spots mentioned in Surfing USA, because Surfing USA is very much a travelogue. It was inspired by both the melody of Sweet Little 16 from Chuck Berry, but also Twistin' USA by Chubby Checker. Judy Bowles, the girl that Brian is dating, she has a brother named Jimmy, And Jimmy is an avid surfer. So Jimmy gives Brian this list of all these surf spots that he's very, very familiar with. And Brian gives those surf spots to Mike Love. Mike Love kind of molds them into a usable song that goes along with the melody Brian's playing on the piano. And Brian didn't purposely steal Chuck Berry's music. There was no malice involved in that. I think he was just naive. He just liked that boogie-woogie kind of Chuck Berry riff. They played it on their guitars. They played it on the piano. And I think he was truly naive. Like, you know, I'm just going to kind of build on this little riff here, and we're going to do a surfing version of Twistin' USA with all these different surfing spots. But Surfin' USA becomes a number three hit, followed by Surf City, which, you know, had Brian's fingerprints all over it. And they're off and going. But yeah, the pressure then was album after album. And in 1963, the Beach Boys had three albums. They had Surfin' USA, they had Surfer Girl, and they had Little Deuce Coupe.
How much filler's in there?
There is a little bit, yeah. The Surfin' USA album has, I think, five instrumentals, which some people, there's two schools of thought. Some people feel it's filler. Other people feel that it's their most authentic surf album because it has a lot of guitar instrumentals and some keyboard instrumentals. It kind of approached the authentic surf music, which was always instrumental. But I do think it's a fair claim that it was a little bit of padding because the album had to be put out so fast. And instrumentals were easier to record. They were familiar with them. They're already playing them in their live show. They were simple to record. You could go in and get a master take pretty quickly. And then on the Little Deuce Coupe and the Surfer Girl album, there was some overlap of songs there too. Not necessarily intentionally, I think. It was just everything was happening so fast for the Beach Boys. Capitol had put out an album called Shutdown without the Beach Boys knowing about it. Capitol sort of misappropriated the title Shutdown. And they put out this album called Shutdown. They just had Shutdown at 409 on it by the Beach Boys, and then 10 other songs that were like hot rod songs done by other folks. It kind of stole the thunder a little bit from Shutdown because the Beach Boys probably could have put an album out themselves called Shutdown. So at that point, the Shutdown album does very, very well on the strength of Shutdown and 409. And Capitol says, well, hey, let's do another car album. So the Beach Boys come up with the Little Deuce Coupe album, which is kind of like a theme album almost, a lot of automotive-related songs on Little Deuce Coupe. They borrow some of their car songs that had already been released on that. So there is some overlap there too, yeah. But then certainly by 64, sort of outside the purview of my book kind of thing, but obviously I know a lot about the whole Beach Boys career, not just up to 63. By 64, I mean, the creativity is just flowing and flowing. I mean, the number of albums and great songs that they did in 64, 65, 66 comes Pet Sounds, 67 would have been Smile. So the thing that separated them from most bands that self-destructed in 3 to 5 years was Brian Wilson's musical genius, Mike Love's great lyrics, and their vocal harmony as a family unit, and the perseverance. Being a musician, you know how competitive the music industry is, and in the 60s, to be on the record chart, and just pick up any copy of Billboard and you look at what the top 10 or top 20 or top 40 was, I mean, the competition was just off the charts.
James B. Murphy, Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961 to 1963, from McFarlane. And it was such an innocent time back then. The whole business was still, for lack of a better term, still inventing itself, especially in the rock and roll era. There are so many asides in this book that are really fun, including the story of David McClellan. You've got a couple nice pictures of him. And I hear you giggle there, but, you know, a guy like David McClellan could only exist in an era like that back then, where they look at one of their friends and go, okay, you're going to be our PR guy. Well, I don't really have any experience doing that. It doesn't matter. You're our buddy and you're our PR director. Share the story of him.
Yeah, David he's a really great guy. I found him actually through an online auction. I bought some Beach Boy memorabilia that I was going to use for my book. And I just happened to write him a note and say, you know, hey, do you have anything else like this? Because this is kind of unusual. And he writes back and says, well, yeah, I do, actually. I've got a whole file of early Beach Boy stuff. I used to be their director of publicity. Well, I almost fell off my chair. So I wrote back to him, and we corresponded through email and things like that. Eventually, he shared a lot of his collection with me. And the story was, basically, they were playing at a show, and he kind of went there. And he was a 19-year-old freshman in college, and he was going to study journalism. And he was writing a column, a music column, for a newspaper called the Azusa Herald. And it's from Azusa, A-Z-U-S-A, Azusa, California. and the Beach Boys were playing at the what was called the Azusa Teen Club, which was basically a gymnasium recreation center that the local city council and the founding fathers of Azusa basically set up to fight the problem of teenage delinquency. It was a way to kind of get the teens off the street on a Friday night, play some music, bring in some bands, sell some soda pop, and give them a healthy outlet to keep them out of trouble. So the Beach Boys played the Azusa Teen Club several times in 62. David meets them, likes them a lot, and talks to them and talks to Murray Wilson. Murray hears that, you know, he's a freshman journalism major, and I guess he figures, well, he can probably write as better than any of my boys or whatever. So he's got some journalism experience, you know, probably not a lot. He hires him as director of publicity. He brings him down from Azusa south to Hawthorne for a couple of nights a week to watch the Beach Boys rehearse. David becomes good friends with the Beach Boys, especially Dennis Wilson, the drummer in the Beach Boys, who I think he was closest in age to. And he becomes good friends with Murray Wilson. And he starts writing all their press releases, and he starts taking photos of them and putting out press releases, traveling with them. Sometimes he would even wear one of the Pendleton shirts that they used to wear in the early days. And he becomes their ad hoc director of publicity. Now, fortunately, David kept all copies of all his press releases. So he had press releases, he had press clippings, he had photographs, he had signed pieces, he had sheet music. And it was just a treasure trove of Beach Boy memorabilia. And the beauty of it from a writer slash researcher historian kind of thing was no other book on the Beach Boys had ever discovered David McClellan. I thought I knew everything there was to know about the Beach Boys, but I had never heard of this guy, David McClellan, that he was their first director of publicity and promo guy. And here he was, and he was legit. He was the real deal. He had all the documents and the stories. In fact, there is a great story that ties into something we spoke about before. Murray Wilson, you know, they would sit there and pontificate a little bit and have his pipe, and he was very much the patriarch of the family and the music group at the time, and he kind of took David McClellan under his wing a little bit, too, in a paternal way, and he would tell him, David, we know that the average lifespan for a rock and roll group is 5 years. That's all we have. We're going to give it our best shot for 5 years, and here we are 55 years later. David always got a kick out of that story. He was the one that actually told me that story when Murray related that to him. And we had a good laugh about that because that's how the music industry was. And even the Beach Boys, with a musical prodigy and talent like Brian Wilson, they were still thinking, this is not going to last forever. It's maybe 5 years tops, and we're done. That's the kind of mind frame, I think, that they had in 62, 63 when they first started out.
That's what was interesting about coming of age, as you did in that time period, and me in the 70s, but we lived through a period where there never was this before. This rock and roll thing just kind of was birthed. And other forms of music, that's basically what happened in a popular sense. You had the music of your life and those sorts of things. That went on for like 25 years. Well, we're still in the rock era. And I remember Mick Jagger was quoted as saying, hey, I'm not going to be up there at the age of 45. Doing what? No, Mick, you're not. You're going to be doing it at the age of 85. So
yeah,
there.
Right.
But who knew? As we visit today with James Murphy, the book is called Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961 to 63. It is available from McFarlane. And believe me, it doesn't matter how long we talk here because we are only, and I mean only, scratching the surface with what is in this book, from the pictures, many of which you're not going to see anywhere else, to some of the stories, to the asides, and as we were talking about the director of publicity, David McClellan, you've got a picture of him with his girlfriend, and they look about as 1962 as humanly possible. But let me ask you this. David Marks and some of the lineup shifts that happened with the Beach Boys really impacted things later on with Brian Wilson, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Sure, sure. That's an interesting point, actually. Shortly after the February 1962 session, where they record early versions of, say, Surf and Safari, Surfer Girl, and two other songs, they're struggling to find that all-important follow-up single to Surfin', and nothing's happening. The record companies are turning them down. They've got no record contract. Well, Al Jardine is not too enthused about the idea of being in a pop group. Jardine's musical sensibilities were more folk, acoustic music, folk trio, Kingston trio, things like that. So Jardine decides to leave. So by mid-February, just days after the recording session on February 8th, Jardine quits. group takes it kind of hard because Jardine has a really beautiful voice that fit in with the Beach Boys' harmonies just perfectly. Brian really, really takes it hard. And they're like, well, you know, why do you want to quit? So he doesn't really see much of a future in the Beach Boys at that time. And quite frankly, it's understandable. And he's thinking, well, I want more of a career. I'm going to go back to college. I'm going to take a pre-dental curriculum, maybe with the hope of being a dentist someday, a nice stable career. And I'll do music on the side. You know, I'll always be playing music and be interested in music, but I'll do it on the side. So that's Jardine's plans. Well, they're now knocked down to a quartet. They were not a very, very great live band early on. They had to sing and play at the same time, which is very, very difficult to do, especially if you're new and you've got any level of stage fright when you first get up in front of people. It's all happening live, so to speak. So they needed more musical support. So they go across the street, and David Marks was at the time, I think, about 13 years old, maybe. Yeah, probably 13 and a half. He had been friends with Carl Wilson since the late 50s. They both got guitars for Christmas, and they both played together, and they were both huge Chuck Berry fans. David Marks was taking some guitar lessons from a fellow by the name of John Moss, M-A-U-S, who goes on to later fame in the Walker Brothers. He's one of the Walker Brothers. Well, Moss is about 16 or 17 at the time, and he's giving guitar lessons to David Marks. And Marks says, well, you know, a buddy of mine, he'd like to take some lessons too. Well, that buddy was Carl Wilson. So Carl starts taking some lessons with John Moss, and he teaches them some lead lines and some things to do and basically tries to strengthen their rock and roll vocabulary on the guitar. So after a while, they stop taking lessons, but they continue to play guitar every day together. So David and Carl build this great lead and rhythm guitar kind of unit that Brian then picks up on. Brian's got the piano and the keyboards and the harmony intact. Mike is their lyricist, plays a little bit of sax, and Dennis is becoming more proficient on the drums. So this is how the band kind of starts to coalesce. Pretty much by the end of February, they go across the street. It's a Sunday night, I think, because Bonanza's on TV. Marks is, like I said, 13 and a half. He's in his pajamas. He's going to school the next day. And Brian and Carl say, hey, David, would you like to join the group? And his parents are a little unsure. What does this mean? I mean, he's only 13 and a half. I think he's in eighth grade, perhaps, or, you know, maybe, yeah, probably eighth grade. So he's real young. He's a kid. But he's very good for his age on the guitar, especially playing rhythm guitar. So anyway, Marks joins the group. So now that's the new lineup of the Beach Boys. Brian, Carl, and Dennis Wilson. Mike Love, their cousin, and now their neighbor, David Marks. Well, that goes on from, say, March of 62, all of the rest of 62, into early 63. Well, Brian starts to realize that, hey, I can't do it all. I can't write the songs, arrange the songs, produce demos, do scratch vocals, produce the actual session, play the bass guitar, play keyboard, and tour at the same time. I just can't be in two places at once. And Brian, I think, soon tired of touring. It's fatiguing. It's not meant for everybody. I think even performing, my own feeling is, you know, he probably enjoyed it in the beginning, and it lost its thrill very, very early on. So Brian comes up with this great idea, in my opinion. He says, you know, hey, listen, I'll stay home and write the music. I'll do the demos. I'll do the arrangement, the production. I'll get musicians in. I'll have everything ready. You guys go out on the road and tour, sing our current songs, our current hits, build the repertoire. And then when you come off the road, I'll have a whole batch of new songs. We'll go into the studio. We'll record them. And we'll have a new album out in, you know, record-breaking time. So in order to do that, though, he needs to have a replacement for himself on the road, someone who can sing like him, the high part and the harmonies, and someone who can play bass guitar. Well, that someone is Al Jardine. Well, Jardine now is taking organic chemistry, is struggling with his pre-dental curriculum, and he's realizing that, well, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should have stayed with the Beach Boys, because by now they've had, you know, Surfing USA, Shutdown, Little Deuce Coupe, Surfer Girl. They've had some nice hits. And he's thinking, well, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should have stayed with the band. You know, this organic chemistry is not so much fun. So he gets a call from Brian Wilson. Hey, Al, would you like to go out on the road and sing and play my parts? Well, that sounds real good to Jardine. So that's what they do. Brian stays home. Al fills in for him on the road. So it's this perfect arrangement. Murray was a little upset because Murray kind of felt like, hey, you know, you're letting your fans down and people pay their hard-earned $1.50 to see you play, and they expect the Beach Boys to be playing and they expect you, Brian, to be there. So Murray gives him some jazz kind of thing. But Brian is a pretty strong guy at 19, 20, 21. And he says, no, this is what I want to do. I want to stay home. I want to write songs. I want to work in the studio. the studio was really his domain. That's really where he was the most comfortable and the most proficient. And he hits upon this genius formula, really. You guys go out and perform. I'll stay home and write. You come off the road. We'll record. We'll have an album out in a month or so. And then repeat that cycle kind of thing for as long as the muse stays with us. So Jardine does that. Jardine goes out and tours for him. Brian stays home. Well, coming from Chicago in late August of 63, the Beach Boys play a show in Chicago. David Marx is with them. Murray is with them. And they're driving from Chicago in two different rental cars and U-Hauls, and they're hauling their own guitars and their amplifiers, and they drive from Chicago to Brooklyn, New York, to play some big rock and roll review in Brooklyn, New York. Well, on the way there, they get into a fight, Murray Wilson and David Marx. Now, again, David is, I think he has just turned 15. Yeah, his birthday is in late August. So I think he had just turned like 15. He's a young kid. He's maybe a sophomore in high school. He gets into a fight with Murray Wilson. Not a good thing. He's kind of cocky. He's a little arrogant. And they're tired. They've been playing lots of one-night stands, driving 500-600 miles, poorly arranged rock and roll tours. Nobody learned anything after Buddy Holly, it seems like. You know, the tours were just zigzagging all over the Midwest. So they're tired. They're tired. And anyway, they get into a fight. And in a spur of the moment, in the heat of the moment, Mark says, well, you know what? I quit. And Murray says, oh, yeah? Well, I'll hold you to it. So the other guys in the band don't really think he's going to quit. They're like, ah, that's just David. He's just blowing off steam. Yeah, that, you know, so what? You know, we always do that. Well, anyway, Murray kind of holds him to it because Murray's, I think, a little shrewder now in the music industry. And David Marx had 20% of the Beach Boy Corporation. So when the Beach Boys signed May 24th of 1962, there was five equal shares. Everybody had 20%. The three Wilson brothers, Mike Love, and David Marx. I kind of think that Murray knew this. He's like, you know, wait a second. David's got 20% of all Beach Boy earnings in the future corporation. If I can get him out of the band, we can roll that 20% back into the family unit. So anyway, David leaves. Murray holds him to it. I kind of think in hindsight, David should have had some advice from an attorney because I think he kind of gets the short end of the stick. But what happens to Brian as a unintended consequence of this is now Al Jardine has to come back as a full-time member. He can't just come back on an ad hoc basis to fill in for Brian. Marx is out of the picture, so Marx leaves completely. Now they're back down to four, and Jardine has to come back as a fifth full-time member. When that happens, Brian has lost his road replacement. So Brian now starts going back out on the road. So that happens around October of 63, and by December of 64, about maybe 14 months later, after touring, writing, arranging, composing, producing, singing, playing on all these records in that 14-month period, the pressure on Brian was just tremendous. And that's when he has his first very, very public nervous breakdown on a plane. The Beach Boys are traveling to a show in Houston. And he just says, hey, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. I got to stay home. And that's when they first bring in Glenn Campbell, and then Glenn Campbell plays with them for a few shows. Campbell, of course, has his own career aspirations. He moves on, and then they get a fellow by the name of Bruce Johnston, who had been very, very active in the early rock and roll scene from the late 50s on, actually. But that's the unintended consequence. Marx quits. Jardine has to come back as the full-time member. Brian loses his road replacement and has to now be a permanent member of the touring band, which was really not what was necessary for Brian. Brian should have been protected and probably kept from the pressures of touring because he was much more valuable and much more at home and at peace in the studio with musicians who spoke his language and creating.
What became of Marx?
Marx, he forms his own group called David Marx and the Marxmen. He gets a record contract with Warner Brothers. He has a couple of albums and singles on Warner Brothers. He forms another group in the late 60s called Moon, and he becomes an excellent guitarist. He goes to music school, conservatory, becomes like a classical guitarist, very, very proficient on the guitar, and has some struggles. Actually, there's a great book, actually, about David Marx. It's called The Lost Beach Boy, and it's written by David Marx and a fellow by the name of John Stebbins. So if any of your listeners want to know more about David Marx, that's the book to get, actually. It's called The Lost Beach Boy by David Marx and John Stebbins. So he kind of goes through a rough patch there for a little bit. Let's face it, the elephant in the room, when you think about David Marx, is hey, you were one of the Beach Boys. You could have had the money, the fame, but for a heat of the moment, spur of the moment, cocky remark from a 15-year-old boy. I've met David. He's the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. He's got a really healthy look at what happened. Life has been good to him now. He's probably in his late 60s now, I think, probably. And the Beach Boys have brought him back from time to time. In the 90s, he came and toured with them for a little bit. He was on their huge 50th anniversary tour in 2012. They played like 74 shows in four or five continents, and they brought David Marks in for that. Excellent guitarist. He's really cool to watch on stage. He's got this great stage presence, I think, and stage personality. And just a very nice, humble, good guy. In fact, that's a whole other chapter, actually. It's his old resurrection and renaissance actually has been very, very fun and sort of comforting to watch, actually.
James, I'll tell you, we could sit here and talk for days about this. Congratulations on what you've done here. And one thing we like to do here on Book Corner is allow our authors and our guests to have a final word. And so I know we've covered a lot of ground here. And your book, again, is called Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961 through 63. James B. Murphy. McFarlane is the publisher. I wholeheartedly recommend this book to you to show you how well James is thought of. He's going to be doing the liner notes coming up for a release later on in the summer, a Holy Grail release for the Beach Boy completist out there, their earliest recordings. James, give me a final word here, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for reaching out to me and contacting me, for reading the book so thoroughly, because in all our conversations, both on the air and off the air, it was immediately clear to me that you not only read the book, but you seriously digested it. So I really, really appreciate that. I guess my final thought is, I think a huge thank you from Beach Boy fans is owed this fellow Brad Rosenberger. Brad is a co-owner and co-partner of Omnivore Recordings. It's a little independent record company. They've got about 200 releases, actually. Go to omnivore.com or just Google them and look up their discography. But Brad is a huge Beach Boy fan. He's a huge Brian Wilson fan, very knowledgeable about the band, and has taken their history to heart kind of thing. And he has really been the driving force behind this 2-CD release that's coming out August 26th. It's going to be called Becoming the Beach Boys, which is built upon the title of my book, and I was very happy and honored for that. Brad is a little bit like you, actually. Brad got my book right away when it first came out and loved it and called me, and we had great conversations about it. And I think the book sort of inspired him to say, you know, well, maybe we can finally release these early Height Morgan sessions after 55 years and tons of litigation and court battles and everything else like that. So the legal dust is finally settled. It's an authorized release from the Beach Boys themselves. The Beach Boys are behind it. They're 100% in on it kind of thing. But Brad has really been the guy that kind of was at the forefront of making this release happen. I was honored to be asked to write the liner notes. It was a real fun and thrilling experience for me. I've heard all the tapes, of course. I've seen the package. And I think Beach Boy fans are going to be really, really excited. These are historical documents and recordings of what I think is America's greatest band in their infancy. You can hear the hints of harmonic genius that are to come. You hear the talking in the studio, working out various songs. You hear, you know, all the missteps and the miscues, the master takes. You hear everything that has ever survived on tape, every second of surviving tape. It's all been remastered by Mark Lynette, who is an award-winning audio engineer. He's worked with the Beach Boy catalog for many, many years. A fellow by the name of Alan Boyd, who is a Grammy Award winner for the Smile Sessions box set that the Beach Boys did. And Alan has been their archivist for, I think, at least 20 years and probably knows more about the Beach Boys than any single living human being and just the nicest guy in the world, actually. He was a friend of the project. He weighed in with his expertise. So between Brad, Alan Boyd, Mark Lynette, in a very peripheral way, myself with the liner notes, it's a really good package, and I think Beach Boy fans are going to enjoy it. They're going to enjoy it from a historical point of view, and this is where it all began. If you love the Beach Boys, this is where it began.
Fascinated. I can't wait to hear that stuff. And once again, Becoming the Beach Boys, 1961, 1963. James B. Murphy. McFarlane is the publisher. Hey, thanks again for joining us today. It was really a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much for calling me.
And I want to remind you that Book Corner is a service of Tony Basilio, the radio show, and also TonyBasilio.com as we conclude another exciting, action-packed edition here on Book Corner.